Everyone, today we are talking with the wonderful, very much revered Beverly Jenkins, who is the author of, we came up with a number while we were talking, but many, many books to sum up. And those books follow the principles of story and engross the reader and capture you and pull you in exactly the way that you want a book to do those things. So here is my thought for you today about our sponsor, Author Accelerator. If you are in the midst of trying to write a book and finding that it is not pulling the reader in the way that you want, that you cannot find the train of the story, whether that book is a novel or a memoir, Author Accelerator book coaches really can help. You all know that I've worked with Author Accelerator's Jenny Nash on my first and honestly on also now on my second novels, and Jenny's ability to see through the forest that I have built and come up with the trees that make up the real path of my story is it's amazing. It's astonishing. And she has taught the book coaches that she has trained to do that exact same thing. So if you're looking for a book coach, I strongly suggest that you head to authoraccelerator.com and get a free match with somebody who can help you out. And if you would like to learn to be that person who can see the path of the trees through the forest to help other writers find their books, you gotta check out Author Accelerator's Book Coach Training. It's great. It's fantastic. It includes lots of information on not just learning to be a book coach, but learning to run a book coach side hustle or a book coach business. I've watched a lot of the videos. I've been a part of some of this. It is a really wonderful and amazing way to set yourself up right for doing a thing that I think a lot of us truly, truly love. So, authoraccelerator.com, check it all out, and that's it.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
KJ Delatonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the podcast, the weekly podcast where we talk about writing all the things, fiction, nonfiction, short pieces, long pieces, essays, pitches, proposals. In short, this is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
And I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels, and my new one is called Roommate. You can always find more about me at serenabowen.com or at the bookstore near you. And today, we have a guest. And I...
Yes, but you didn't let me introduce myself.
Snap!
And I have a big... I have an introduction. Like, come on.
All right.
It's my first time saying this. Okay, are we ready?
Go.
Are we ready? I am KJ Delantonia, the New York Times best-selling author of The Chicken Sisters. This is my first time saying that, and I'm going to have it tattooed pretty much somewhere. Not sure where yet. I am also the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, the former editor of the Motherlode blog at the New York Times, and all the things. But I'm really reveling in that bestseller thing, because that has never happened to me before. So I'm having a moment. It'll be a little old by the time this podcast airs, but it's never going to be old for me.
Yay!
Now you can talk about our guest.
Today we have a guest, and so excited to talk to Beverly Jenkins, the multi-award-winning author of so many wonderful historical novels. Her first one was published in the mid-90s, and she is still going strong. She was the recipient of the 2017 Romance Writers of America Nora Roberts Lifetime Achievement Award, as well as the 2016 Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award for Historical Romance. And I have had the pleasure of being at several conferences where Beverly Jenkins has presented wonderful sessions about craft for novels. And so that is why we wanted to talk to her today, because she is just a master of craft and a master of so many things. So welcome, Beverly Jenkins.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
To this. I'm on deadline, so I only got three working brain cells, so I'm giving them all to you. So bear with me.
Well, we appreciate it.
We do appreciate it.
We know what it's like. I'm getting something back from an editor today, so I'm only off deadline for another like 2.5 hours. I'm free until then. Before we even start, I have actually only read your historical novels, but you write contemporary novels as well, right?
I have, I think...
The Blessings series.
Well, I have 5 romantic suspense also.
Okay.
And then the Blessings series, I'm on book 11, which is what I'm on deadline with. And they call it women's fiction. So I'm playing in all the sandboxes and having a good time and blessedly have a great editor who allows me to do this, has faith enough in my writing to let me spread my wings a little bit. So she's a blessing.
Wonderful. I am always impressed. And the reason I leaned into talking about your historicals is that I write contemporary because I am afraid to get it wrong. So can you tell us a little bit about what it took for you to confidently bring forward your first historical time point in fiction? And how did you arrive at the willingness to go there?
Well, it's the first thing that sold, basically. So you go with what they buy. My first book, I've been working on it because, the market was basically closed to African-American, mass market back then. This is like mid-80s when I first started just dabbling around. And I was writing basically just for me. So when my agent started sending it around and Ellen Edwards at Avon Books, who was the executive editor then, bought the book on my husband's birthday, which is June 3rd, 1993. And it was 700 pages of nothing but heat. I mean, it was like you open that book and, and steam would come out of it. You needed... asbestos gloves to carry it around. And Ellen said, well, Bev, we love your writing. We need a story. And I was like, well, hell, you got to write a story? She's like, yeah. So I know, first-time novelist, you think you know what the hell you're doing and you don't. So since I was writing about a Buffalo soldier and an Oberlin-educated school teacher, both who happened to be African-American. It didn't make sense to me to play these characters against a majority white background. So I tell people that I grew up with African-American history in my home because my mom was black before it was fashionable. So I knew that I could put the history behind these characters. And that was one of the, to back up a little bit, a couple, 10 or 15 years when you had editors in New York who edited romance who were saying that, there will never be black historicals because we don't have the history, you don't have the scope, you don't have the depth to paint characters against that background, which was of course bullshit. But I knew, and having worked in libraries most of my adult life up to that point, that we did have the history. My mom told me we had the history. I'd read the history. So I decided after doing some research to put it against the Great Exodus of 1879. Which is the first mass exodus out of the South of African-American people. This is after the Civil War and after the gutting of Reconstruction. Not to be confused with the Great Migration of 1900, where everybody went north, Chicago, Detroit, those kinds of places. These folks went west. So I set my characters against this kind of a background, and it got like rave reviews. And, you know, I had to put a bib list in the back because I had people saying, well, did black people really do that? Did they really live there? Do you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, you know, here's the bib list. You know, you can go look and then you can talk to me later, right? So it never occurred to me to be afraid to write a historical, you know, to come all the way around to what your question was. It never occurred to me that, number one, that I was doing something that nobody had ever done before in romance. I was just telling the story about my hunky, you know, soldier and my very, very feisty school marm.
Well, the talking about the bibliography just kind of brings me to my another question that I really wanted to ask you, which is, it seems like you've just always been able to be so, how do you find the line between being historically accurate, which you are, and also having some really fun characters who, okay, maybe there were not so many female pirates tying people to beds, you know, but, which is fine because that's, you know, that's what we do, right?
Right.
But I'm working on some history right now, and I'm really struggling with that line between, like, okay, I want to get it right, but I also want to have a good time. How did you manage to cross that?
Well, you know, I always try and have my characters wear the history. That way I can sort of avoid info dumps and that kind of thing. But, you know, I try not to make them too over the top. Mm-hmm. People roll their eyes, you know, and they have to go outside to find them from, you know, eyes rolling so hard. I think, you know, once you're doing this for a while, you sort of know, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that, you know, there's a way to say, well, you know, if you do this and you do this and you do this and you do this, that it will come out okay.
Did you feel like you needed, like, permission to that's great. Because we struggle with, I struggle with that. Anyway.
Never. I mean, you know, what are they going to do? Not read the book? I mean, that's fine. I got 41 books in print. You know, you can always read something else. Or, you know, romance is so vast, you can always read another, you know, author. And, you know, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but of course you want people to read your books. But I have not run across any pushback from people saying, well, you know, this is ridiculous. I have had readers in classrooms who have had pushback about the history from professors.
Huh.
Interesting. One of my readers, longtime reader, has a PhD in history, and she did, I don't know if they were talking in class or if she was doing a paper, but anyway, she referenced the Great Exodus of 1879, and a professor said she'd made it up.
Oh, dear.
Wow.
And you must be mistaken, and, you know, you've got this mixed up with something else, and, you know, the whole mansplain kind of thing, right? So she was telling me about it. She said, well, luckily, Miss Bev, you put your sources in the backs of your books. So I said, well, how did he feel, you know, having to eat that crow and then take his foot out of his mouth? And she said, well, he didn't feel very good about it, but she got to be in the class. And she said she thinks it was because, but, you know, one of the things that she said was that, you know, throughout her whole academic journey, she had never read outside of my books about the Exodus of 1879. So I didn't feel I needed permission to write about anything. And another great thing about having great editors is that I never got any pushback from them either.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I've been lucky to have great editors. A good percentage of them have been women of color. So I don't have to, you know, explain a whole lot. I mean, I have to explain stuff to copy editors, of course, sometimes. But my editors get my books. And that gives you, I think, the confidence and the freedom to go ahead and write about, you know, what you want. So
another thing I've always appreciated about your choice of settings and characters and time periods. Well, in romance, when you're constructing a romance and you're deep in the weeds and, you know, you're doing sort of the math about who's on the page together and not to get too far from the hero. And there's a lot of convention that we sort of absorb and carry with us as we write a romance. But what I love about your whole list of books is your ability to definitely stay within the romance convention so that any romance reader who picks up your book will have that the satisfying hallmarks of romance that she's looking for, but also to pick things that are not the same. So it's the little bit of the familiar and the different. Every book has the familiar romance and this brand new thing that I didn't know I needed to read about, especially with setting romances in America. I mean, you know, just full stop, that is not that usual. Are there other American romances that you sort of had in your mind when you did this, or were you just, I'm writing what?
Meaning historical.
Yeah, historical American romance is almost not a thing. When I think of it, I think of you.
Okay. Well, I grew up reading, I guess what would be, I mean, definitely American romance, historical. And there were not that many. But Susan Johnson at the beginning of her career was absolutely fabulous. She said a lot of her stuff in places like Wyoming and Montana. And that's who I borrowed the idea about the biblist from.
Okay.
Because if you read those early Susan Johnsons, she's got footnotes on the page.
You know? Wow.
But it never occurred to me again, I guess because, you know, I was new and young and you know, quote unquote dumb, that I wasn't supposed to write about America.
Right.
We had, of course, Regency back then, and we had, you know, Joanna Lindsay and all of those, you know, Julie Garwood and all those great ladies who were doing, you know, the whole English thing. But it never occurred to me, well, number one, I couldn't have written anything over for that because I hadn't done the research. And that would have probably been really problematic in trying to convince people that, you know, because we're still having that issue right now. Yes, there were people of color in the 1800s in England. Hello, read Vanessa Riley, please. So it never occurred to me that I was doing something different. I was just trying to tell my story that was centered on people who looked like me and my sisters and my mom and, you know, my friends. And I guess I sort of carved out my own niche because I was, you know, I was on that shelf for a long time alone, you know, praying for other authors of color to tell their stories, Melissa Cole and Rebecca and, you know, and all of those ladies. So mm-hmm. It never occurred to me that I was doing something that was quote unquote different.
As you described the Western ones, I do realize there was definitely a genre of Western. And in fact, one of my favorite ones from you was a Philadelphia dressmaker who rides out west and ends up finding her destiny there. And
it's something like love. Yeah.
Yeah. And I loved the Philadelphia dressmaker details too, you know, who her clients were and why. And that was just really rich on the page without, you know, taking over the story.
You know, I think that's one of the things that many romance writers do really well is if you have a seamstress, I mean, you don't want to do it so much that, you know, like I said, you know, it puts people to sleep, but people want those details, you know, it just a little, I think the little touches, it's like adding extra color to a painting. A little bit of glitter here, a little bit of glitter there, you know, maybe a point of red here or a point of yellow there. It makes the picture that much more complete and prettier to look at, I think.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I'm so drawn to historical is because that's my taste as well. And in contemporary, it's actually much easier to fall into the trap of like the romance bubble world where nobody's job really matters, or, you know, it happens. But you mentioned waiting to see other authors on the shelf. And I have to tell you about a strange incident that I caused in a suburban Books a Million store, to the horror of my teenage son. I had been sent to this store with my teenager to buy my other teenager a copy of Invisible Man, so he could read it for a class probably. And I couldn't find it in the fiction section, so I asked a 20-ish employee where I could find it, and he said, "Oh, you need the African American section," and I literature, and I was like, "Great, point the way." So I found it, and it was small, and there was, you know, Ralph Ellison and his peers, and I bought the book, and then I was just turning away, and I saw your books on the shelf there, and I thought, how is a romance reader going to find this Beverly Jenkins novel on this shelf over here when the romance section is four rows away? And I just stopped there for a second, and then I went and found the poor 20-year-old employee again, and I said, "Excuse me, sir, why would you put this book here? You know, if I'm really looking for a romance, I cannot find it. I can't find Beverly Jenkins here if the romance books are over there. Why would you do that?" And my other young teenager was quietly dying a thousand deaths because, you know, once I sent a salad back 5 years ago, and we will never live it down, right? And and I was so upset because, to me, discoverability in all kinds of fiction is just so frustrating. And he to this poor kid's credit, because of course it wasn't his decision where to put this book, and I knew that, and I was polite, but he knew. He said, "Well, you know, we have a code for where everything goes, and I find this also in all kinds of genre fiction. There are some science fiction writers, for example, who are appropriately placed in their section, and then there are some that I, you know, put here." And then he said, "Actually, though, ma'am, if you go look in the romance section, you will find more Beverly Jenkins novels over there." And that calmed me down a wee little bit. And he also said, "When you get your receipt at the counter, write them an email and tell them, because that's how, you know, that's how things get fixed." And I did that, and I never heard a word from them.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, I mean, it was something that came to the forefront when all the hip-hop urban lit books came to the fore. And it's from what I was told by someone who worked at Borders at the time, a black gentleman who was like a district manager. He said that the store actually started, it actually started in a store near me, one of the close Detroit suburbs. And the store was run by, the manager was a black woman. And the hip hop kids who were coming into the store had no idea how to use a bookstore. Because, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, representation matters. They had never read anything that spoke to their demographic. So they're coming in the bookstore, they have no idea where to find it. She was spending all of her staff's time taking these kids by the hand and showing them how to use a bookstore. This is where your books are, blah, blah, blah. So she got basically tired of it. So she put them all in one spot, so that when the kids came in, she could just point, they could get their books, and I guess her sales of these books went through the roof because the kids knew where to find them. And you want to encourage readers, you know, I mean, you don't want to say, "Okay, I'm tired of taking you guys by the hand." Corporate saw this and said, "Oh, let's put all the African-American books in one spot." Like, maybe the majority of African-American women and men who've been using bookstores all our lives didn't know how to use a bookstore either. Yeah. I mean, you know, for a long time, publishers didn't think we read. But that's a whole nother conversation. So they put everything in one spot. Authors hate it.
Sure.
Because, like you said, it cuts down on discoverability, especially for young authors who are just starting out. You know, young romance writers, they need to be in the romance section. Now, me and people like Brenda Jackson, who, you know, we've been out here a while. So you're going to find me all over the store. You're going to find me in romance. You're going to find me in African-American literature. You're going to find me, Lord knows, I had one reader earlier.
You're on the spinner at the grocery store.
I know.
Which is awesome.
I know.
I love that.
I know. And I had one of my readers earlier in my career, and she said, Miss Beth, I found you in Men's Health.
What?
Well, I could, you know, it would be helpful, but I don't quite understand the categorization.
She said, I said, well, you know, on one hand, you're blessed to be in the bookstore anywhere. But, you know, it's about, you know, it should be in the romance section. And that is where up-and-coming romance writers who are of color should be. But, you know, distributors, for some reason, like I said, you know, they figure, I don't know, all in one spot. But some readers enjoy it. Because you have some book clubs that read only African-American authors. And they can go to the section and get the books that they want. But most authors I know of all stripes, no matter what you're writing, absolutely hate it. Absolutely hate it.
I hated it. And I have been in exactly the Books a Million where Serena had this experience. And I know exactly the corner she meant. And it definitely, when I was looking for an author and would frequently be looking for an author that I didn't have any, there was no reason for me to know what color they were,
right?
Because I was, you know, somebody had said, hey, this is a great one, you know, go find it. And then would have to sort of wind my way over there and then sort of ended up standing there going, well, is this for me?
I know.
Like,
I know. And
that's so frustrating.
And that's a problem too, because if you put that in that section, white readers are going to have that conversation with themselves.
Yep.
Which is
like,
stupid.
Does this author even want me? But of course they do.
Of course we do.
You know?
Yeah. So, yeah, I've been ranting about that for a while. In fact, during my 2016 RWA keynote luncheon speech, I told them, you know, African American is not a genre.
Right.
You know, it's not a genre. So, you know, it was skepticism abound, but, you know, it's okay. I got to tell them it's not like they don't know. So anyway.
We shouldn't even go down the RWA rabbit hole,
no,
should we?
No, we're not doing that.
We're not doing that.
Coming up on the anniversary of Christmas Eve, we're not doing that.
Yeah. So when you sit down to, first of all, how many books do you generally have going at once?
One.
Do you just want one?
I don't have the bandwidth to do more than one. I need to concentrate just on one. I know some people can do more than one, maybe have two or three. my late girlfriend, L.A. Banks, she did vampires and she did romance. And if she was working on two projects at once, the vampire books had to be in a different room in the house. She said,
I can get that.
Yeah, she said the energy was different. So she's in this old brownstone writing vampire hunters in one room and her romance in another. So
I like it.
I do too. So, yeah.
Do you start a new one while your editor has the old one, or do you just sort of hang out and wait?
They're hanging out in my head now. I call it my green room. I may not know exactly who they are because I'm a pantser.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have kernels of what possibilities may be. I have to do the next Women Who Dare.
Mm-hmm.
Third book is going to come after I finish this Blessings book. Blessings book is due in January. So in the back of my head, I'm sort of seeing characters. I don't see faces yet. I don't see what the trope's going to be. I don't really know until, you know, that point comes where it's like, ah, you know, until then you're sort of like Moses wandering in the desert, you know, looking for, you know, being led around by the cloud, and you're not really sure where you're going. So
when you sit down that first day, and either, do you pull out a laptop or a notebook?
I do both. At the beginning of my career, everything was longhand. Because back then, you know, that was, you know, you didn't even have computers back then. It was all typewriters and longhand and all of that. And then I started composing on the computer, on the laptop. But for some reason, this book that I'm working on now, it didn't want to do that. You know, it was like legal pad. So I have all these, you know, quilt pieces that I'm now trying to, you know, stitch together. And, you know, and you talk to people who don't write, and they think that those kinds of things are just so strange. But, you know, we as writers know that it's part of the process, that strangeness. So I do both. I do both.
Mm-hmm. And do you... So you said you have the character sort of noodling around in your head, and I know what you mean. I think we all do. Do you sit down and sort of say, I mean, do you sit down and kind of go, I've got this scene in my head. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to let this one out, and then I'll figure out where it goes later. Or is it more of a, okay, this is, I mean, I literally sometimes am typing, this is going to be about this, because, you know,
yeah.
Just kind of.
I mean, riffing. There's no, I mean, each book is different too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, oh, really?
Yeah, each book.
You don't have like a set thing yet?
No.
Okay.
That's because I'm a panther. You know, I just sort of throw what's going to stick on the wall this time. Each book is different. And I try consciously to make each book different because I want to give my readers a different story every time.
Mm-hmm. And so you feel like it needs to be a different story for you as a writer as well?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. For a while, I couldn't finish a book in my office. For some reason, I either had to go sit on the bed and write, or if I was, because right now I'm in my bedroom, because my office is trashed. It was either use the office or use the bedroom. Some books wanted the office first, some books wanted the bedroom first, and then I would switch at the end of the, I mean, it's just... It's sort of a madness kind of thing.
we get it. Yeah. You're looking at an office that I share with my partner now. We are listeners. We're on Zoom, although we don't put the Zoom out there. And I never write in here. Never.
Yeah.
Never. Ever. I don't write in here. It's just, I just don't. I could revise in here.
Yeah. But when the family was here, I would use the kitchen table. And my husband was like, you think we ever going to eat dinner on the kitchen table again? I'm like, I don't think so, baby. I don't know.
I need that. I need that space. Yeah. The couch is mine right now. Oh, and yeah, fortunately we have two eating tables because one of them is with my stuff right now. Get it. Well, we have spent some amazing time talking craft and historicals, and I'd like to just pause for a moment because we're going to have a word from the sponsors that help us keep this podcast going, and then we're going to come back and talk about what kinds of things we've been reading in the past months and year.
Sound good.
Hey, it's Jess, your friendly neighborhood Great Courses Plus enthusiast here to talk about what I'm learning this week. My son and I are learning about high school chemistry. Woo-hoo! It's just as much fun the second time around. We've needed a little bit of help, so we went to the high school chemistry class with Frank Cardula on the Great Courses Plus app. You can download your app to your phone or to your iPad, and you can listen to unlimited streaming access to thousands of video or just audio courses on anything that interests you. If you're crazy and you want to go back and learn high school chemistry, you can learn high school chemistry, to my great delight. Great Courses Plus has something for everyone. There's music. I think I'm going to do botany next. I'm very excited. If you are interested, get the Great Courses app on your phone. You can go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting and you will get an entire month of unlimited access for free. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting and get learning your chemistry.
Okay. So you're laughing because in reality,
it'll be a long pause and all that. Yeah.
Exactly. And in reality, behind the scenes, we just stop for a moment and we all look a little sheepish and then we move right on to talking about books. But that's how the podcast sausage gets made.
Hey, nothing wrong with that.
So, Beverly, you warned us that as someone who's cranking away on a deadline, you haven't been reading wildly at the moment. So we thought we'd just ask you for some stuff you have enjoyed recently.
Well, the last thing I read, I had to look on my Kindle, which is like groaning because it's got so many books on it, was The Last J.D. Robb.
I was listening to his podcast just this morning.
Yeah, what's the title? The title was Shadows and Death, number 51 in the series. I absolutely adore.
Seriously?
Seriously,
number 51.
Book 51.
I mean, I knew he was prolific, but man.
It's Nora Roberts.
Nora Roberts.
Oh, she. What am I saying? I was listening to J.D., somebody else. That was crazy. Yeah, Nora Roberts is... Oh, I feel like such a dope, but we're going to leave this in. I was listening to a different podcast with a different dude named JD, but not Rob. But I had Rob in my head because I only think JD Rob, and how I managed to do that and have it be a dude, I don't know. Because of course I know that's Nora Roberts.
Yeah, book 50 was Golden in Death, because, you know, 50's gold.
Ah.
She's so good at this.
Clever, yes.
Oh, yeah, book 51, Shadows and Death. She's got another one coming out in February. God, if I had her discipline, I would own mountains too, I guess. but that's what, in Love Between the Covers, that's what Eloisa James, in talking about Nora, you know, said that, you know, Nora owns mountains. You know, she really does. You've seen awesome. That, haven't you? Have you seen the documentary, Love Between the Covers?
Mm-mm.
Oh. Go to Amazon. It was done. God, it's almost 10 years old now. Lori Kahn, Emmy Award winning. I think it's an Emmy that you get for whatever it is you get for documentaries on TV. I know she worked on Eyes on the Prize, the big civil rights thing.
Mm-hmm.
But she did a documentary on romance and the culture and the fans and some of the readers. And it's absolutely amazing. Won a lot of awards. Anyway, so yeah, Eloisa was talking about Nora.
Owning mountains.
Mountains, yes.
Yeah.
So what else have I read? I haven't read anything but what I'm looking forward to reading.
That is fine. We accept all comers.
I read fantasy. I'm a big fantasy reader. So I have both of the new Jim Butcher, Harry Dresden, books in my Kindle. I'm looking forward to reading Rebecca Roan Horse's. She's an up and coming. Well, she's just won a bunch of awards. A young woman writes native fantasy. It's called The Black Sun. I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to Alona Andrews continuing her Kate Daniel's World with the Blood Air. Will be out January 12th. Hopefully I'll be done with my deadline by then so I can jump right into that for like a day and a half. I love Alona. I could, you know, if I could only have one author for the rest of my life, it would be Alona.
Oh, that's awesome.
Her and her husband, Gordon, are just, Jesus, they're so good. So that's sort of what I'm looking forward to and what I have read in the last 6 months. So,
Wonderful. It's so funny that you brought those up, because when I'm writing, I also think, oh, I don't have any time to read. But sometimes I will request things from Overdrive, and then suddenly, you know, fate just delivers them to me. Because, you know, it takes weeks and weeks, and then I'm like, well, I guess I'm reading The Dark Witch by Nora Roberts, because that's what was. And of course, I don't remember the day that I decided I needed to read about witches, but here we are. So yeah. This week I was enjoying The Dark Witch by Nora Roberts. And then and then also My Last Duchess by Eloisa James, who is just wonderful. And when I read in Eloisa James books, if they're going to a market that's held on the Frozen Thames in 1767, then I know that there was a frozen market on the Thames, you know.
yes. She's going to get it right.
She is going to get it right.
Yeah, she's a Shakespeare fellow, so she knows what she's doing. And plus, she's a very nice lady. So.
Yes, I know. She has been lovely to me, and I appreciate her books very much. And that's my two, KJ.
That's good. Well, so I have been rereading Morgan Jenkins, who was a guest on this podcast. Her Wandering in Promised Lands? I will get it right for you all. That is nonfiction, and I've been reading it as a little historical research because I needed to know some things that I knew she had mentioned. So I've been having a good time. It's such a good book. I'm just going to sink in and reread it. And I have also, just, you know, by the by, been reading Wild Rain by Beverly Jenkins.
You should know
that we do not always do our, you know, I'm not always reading our guest, but it just happens that I was having kind of a depressing reading month for whatever reason. It was kind of the kind of month where you open it and you're like, no.
It's the pandemic.
No. And yeah, this one did not do that. No, this one was like, okay, yeah, let's just turn that page and see what happens to this person. Because, it's juicy fun. Juicy fun.
Yeah, she's something else. I enjoyed writing her.
I could see that.
Got a lot of email after she was, you know, a side character in Tempest. I got a lot of emails and, can we give her our own book? You know, your wish is my command.
Yay. So. Serena gets that email.
Yeah.
I'm not always as nice about it. You want a book about who?
I know. That's how I felt about Nighthawk, you know, which everybody loves, because he was in a previous book and he was just like underwhelming. You know, he was not the hot guy that is on the cover of his book. And you know, a couple of my girlfriends were like, huh? They want a book for him? So I had to give him a Beverly Jenkins makeover and hunk him up and give him a great backstory and all of that. And
he was just misunderstood.
Yeah, there you go. If Lissa Cole can give the Russian hockey player, who never even had a name, if he can get his own book, y'all can do. No. You do what you want.
Lissa K. Adams. Yeah.
Lissa can write anything.
Don't know where I got it.
She's just, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wasn't Alyssa Cole.
No, it's Alyssa K. Adam. But Alyssa Cole is also great. So it's Alyssa Cole, Lissa K. Adams, and I don't even have an excuse for not having any brain cells, but I've definitely proven it today.
And we blame it on the pandemic. Always.
There we go.
Always assign blame.
Yeah. Okay. We all need a t-shirt. Blame it on the pandemic. I like it.
Yeah.
Well, Beverly, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very, very welcome.
Y'all can find Beverly's books in every section of every bookstore and politely reshelve them and read romance on her behalf. You can also find a list of them at her website, beverlyjenkins.net. And they're all there. There's little synopsises, and yeah, you'll end up going down some roads with that. So I hope you will check them out. Do you hang out on any social media? Is that your...
No. Somebody yesterday called Romancelandia Twitter, Beverly Jenkins Romancelandia Internet. I love Absolutely love Twitter.
Excellent.
I'm on Twitter. I have 3 Facebook pages. Ask me why I can't get my books done on time. In fact, tonight is hot chocolate night on my, it's an annual celebration of hot men. Hot men of all colors. We call it hot chocolate night.
That's awesome. So
we're doing that tonight at 8:00. But yeah, I am Author Miss Bev on Twitter. Romance Twitter is called Romancelandia.
Okay.
And we have a ball. We have a ball all the time.
I like it.
Yeah.
We'll have to get you in there, Serena.
Yeah.
Serena's like, no, I'm good. I've got Instagram and Facebook. Oh,
Serena, you will love Twitter. There's so many. I mean, yeah, it can be, you know, a hell mouth. But there are so many smart, snarky, crazy people on Twitter. You will be laughing the whole time. That's the first thing I do when I get up is check my Twitter feed, see what's going on.
It is, when it is good, it is very, very good. The problem is it's been horrid for a little while, but not Romancelandia, but in general. So I've been thinking about going back. I used to do it big, and then now
I avoid that part. Yeah. You know, I'm like, I have to read that part. No. I just read the parts I like, so I have a good time.
Well, again, thank you. Listeners, if you want to talk to us more, the best place to do that is always our Facebook group, the Am Writing group on Facebook. You can find more about the podcast at amwritingpodcast.com. Everything you need to know about us, about Beverly Jenkins, links to everything that we talked about in the show, and everything that I got wrong will be corrected there by me, because, yeah, I would save myself a lot of work if I just thought before I spoke, but that has been true my whole life. Yeah. All right, that's where I am today, and I'm going to let Serena take us out.
Until next week, writers, keep your butts in the chair and your heads in the game.
Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop. Stop. Thank you.